We'll call the Committee on Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance to order. We will do the roll call.
Johnson.
Here.
Lomer.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Here.
Beckerfin.
Here.
Considine.
Here.
Dean.
Here.
Frankie.
Here.
Grossel. Howe. Lucero. Newberger. O'Neill.
I am here. Thank you.
Pinto.
Here.
Costed in an elevator.
Ooglum.
Yes.
Ooglum.
Yeah, here.
Ward.
Here.
Zerwas.
Representative Beckerfin, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have. I just didn't move them.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Today we have a couple overviews. One is the Minnesota School Safety Center, and the other is the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Today we're going to start with the Minnesota Safety Center. So Kevin Reed could come forward and good morning. Welcome to the committee, and thank you for coming today. If you could please state your names for the record and begin presenting your presentation.
Good morning, everyone. Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Joe Kelly, and I serve as the Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management with the Department of Public Safety. Thank you for the opportunity to brief the committee on the Minnesota School Safety Center. The terrible shooting attack at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, has once again thrust the safety of our children while they're at school to top of mind. The Minnesota School Safety Center was reestablished by the legislature in 2013. Going back to 2007, it was a federal grant-funded program, then known as the Safe Learners Program. The mission of the School Safety Center, which Mr. Johnson will elaborate on in a moment, is to help Minnesota schools provide a safe and secure environment for students, families, teachers, staff, and visitors. We serve K through 12 schools, public, private, charter, and tribal, in order to help them be prepared to effectively respond to an incident at their school and to quickly recover from its effects. While the center works closely with the Minnesota Department of Education, it is an element of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Mr. Chair and members, I yield to my colleague and the director of the Minnesota School Safety Center, Mr. Randy Johnson.
Thank you.
Please take
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to brief you, at least give you a thumbnail sketch of what the Minnesota School Safety Center is all about and how we deliver services to the K-12 schools throughout the state of Minnesota. Again, our mission is full spectrum. It's all hazards planning is what we work for, both natural and man-made disasters, all threats, and hazard identification. And our main role is to be linking resources between the schools and the community and also the governmental entities that help contribute to supporting a safe school environment. Staffing for the School Safety Center is three full-time personnel right now. Myself, the director, we have a school resource officer coordinator and also a safe school assessment coordinator who works on facility assessments. When we were first put into place back in 2013, we also had a position which was the emergency planning coordinator, which was overall emergency planning. That position is now vacant. We have $405,000 as an ongoing appropriation in the budget. And I would like to say one thing. The persons that are involved in these positions have strong background in facility assessments, fire service, law enforcement, and schools. We're subject matter experts in some ways, but we're also subject matter learners. We pick up a lot of good information on the different work that we're doing throughout the state, and we employ these best practices to our current trainings. I listed our key partners here for the School Safety Center, and they're varied and many. regional education cooperatives. There's 11 education cooperatives throughout the state of Minnesota, which we have utilized as kind of a conduit to deliver services and training throughout the state. School boards, administrators, staff, line people, and also our public safety partner agencies. We're making that link between the local, county, state, and tribal groups. We also work very strongly with professional associations around education and also in public safety, including the School Board Association, a wide variety of organizations. And then we link with our state agencies. Minnesota Department of Education is a good partner of ours, Department of Health, Public Safety, and many divisions, Office of Communications, Fire Marshal, BCA, Minnesota State Patrol, and the Office of Justice Programs. And again, we make strong links in our training resources to federal resources through the U.S. Department of Education. School safety training. I gave a list here of some of the courses that we do deliver to schools as deliverables, both on-site and in larger venues. And we're continually adding and updating to course curriculum and course content as best practices become made known to us. Many times we are customizing training to the specific audience. It depends whether we are dealing with school administrators, whether we're dealing with school line staff, public safety partners, and also community partners. Each one of them plays a strong role in the safety of our schools. Some of the courses here that we've been very, very active with over the past year as far as requested training is active shooter, violent intruder. We prefer to call it violent intruder because it does not necessarily mean an event was initiated with a firearm. But we need to be thinking of a wider spectrum of things that could impact us. Lockdown with options has also been one that has been very much requested, and we just redesigned a bomb threat response course that has been very well received. I have a couple of diagrams here. One of them, as you can see, is an outline of the map of Minnesota, and this is for 2014-2015. That was the most recent data that we've incorporated into a GIS map. And you're going to see the different colors that are on the map indicating that we have done either field delivery of facility assessment or a training course within that county area, within that school district area. Just because you see a few spots that have white, that there isn't anything, does not mean that we haven't been in contact with various agencies and schools within that specific area, because we do a lot of consulting and resource sharing per request by phone or by email. But this indicates the places that we actually put our feet on the ground. And the big thing that we talk about is being present and walking with our school safety partners. Annually, we individually train about 1,300 individuals, about 6,500 contact hours per year, and we touch about 200 different school districts or school organizations per year. And just to kind of put that in perspective, from MDE data, there's approximately 157 charter schools in Minnesota right now, 477 non-public schools, and 328 public school districts. So there's an awful lot of schools that we do make contact with and provide training. I think the next slide is probably the most important piece of information I wanted to share with you and the committee. We've learned that each school and school district is unique. They are very, very unique. Not only talking about brick and mortar as far as the facilities itself, but who you have as a population within the school building. We have a lot of pre-K programs and early childhood now within many of the schools that we have to be considering when we're putting together our plans. And we also have to consider the partner resources that are available in various parts of the state of Minnesota. The second point I really wanted to speak to directly, we are non-regulatory. And what we have found is that by being non-regulatory, schools seem to be very open to us being able to have those very interesting and candid conversations as far as what are the things that keep them up at night, what are the things that we can assist them with. Being non-regulatory has been a very, very important factor there. These relationships, they're very, very essential. We have to make a statewide presence, and we spend an awful lot of time in greater Minnesota. And being that on-site delivery is very critical and crucial because it gives us an idea of what some of the things that particular school is dealing with as far as their planning processes. School resource officer training. We do about 75 individuals who are public safety licensed officers within the state each year, and we put together both basic school, which we usually do twice a year, and also an advanced strategies where we keep updating newest information that is being impacted for our school resource officers in the school. Many of the courses that we're involved with are involving special needs and things particular to the school, where we're trying to make school resource officers make that shift from the street to the school mindset, because there's a very different way in which we deal within that school community. We also use them to liaison between agencies for public safety, and we've developed some SRO cohort learning opportunities. Right now in Minnesota, there's been a question, how many SROs do we have in the state of Minnesota? And we're estimating through Minnesota Department of Ed data on a survey that was put through in 2014 that there is about 350 full-time or part-time school resource officers throughout the state of Minnesota. And just to give you an idea, about 158 agencies of the 448 recognized law enforcement agencies in the state have a school resource officer assigned specifically from their organization. It's about 38-39%. We talk about emerging topics, and we utilize numerous subject matter experts to help us with those trainings. The next, school threat assessments, that's been a very strong topic of interest recently, putting together threat assessment teams, providing tools and best practice approaches to the schools and their public safety partners to do adequate and timely threat assessments to determine the credibility of threats and what we were going to be doing to respond to possible threats. We incorporate a 360-degree view of that. The see something, say something culture is very, very important. It's not just in our greater communities, but it's in the schools themselves. One of the things we talk about quite a bit with the schools is long- and short-term support for victims of threats, and also supporting reintegration practices for returning students once a threat has occurred. Safe school facility assessments are also a very important part of our work. We develop tools to allow schools to do a self-assessment, but we also help them by actually walking through schools, boots on the ground, doing a facility assessment with them. And we also put together a train-the-trainer portion, so we would have persons from public safety, from the schools themselves, from their facility group, to actually walk through the school. So if we would do one school or two schools within a school district, they could now take the information they learned on the train-the-trainer program and apply it to other schools within their school districts. Again, we consult with school construction projects as they're updating or building new facilities. We do approximately 80 of these per year. We use CEPTED, crime prevention through environmental design principles, and we share solutions to safety concerns that we learned by walking through and doing facility assessments with other schools within our state of Minnesota. Emergency operation planning is another core piece of what we do. This is a multi-hazard, all-hazard type of planning. So when we're thinking about that full spectrum of work that we're doing, violent events are just one sliver of the entirety of identifying threats and hazards within the community that could impact the school. So we assist them in building their crisis plans or emergency operations plans. And finally, school crisis response teams, 119A.035. This was actually brought under the oversight of the Minnesota Department of Education rather than the Department of Public Safety. But we did work with School Safety Technical Assistance Center, which is housed over in the Department of Education, to provide them some resources and models for providing these school crisis response teams. And it's almost a misnomer by saying it's a response team. They don't necessarily, they're not the lights and sirens first responders, but these are the persons that come in to help with behavioral health, emotional needs of a community that's been traumatized for any type of reason. And we utilize the Southwest West Central Crisis Response Team as a model of something that is working very, very well right within the state of Minnesota to provide this type of school crisis response teams. A lot of the schools throughout the state of Minnesota are already doing this on an informal basis, but that is being brought into a more formalized process. So, Mr. Chair and members, thank you for once again allowing us the opportunity to present this thumbnail sketch of the work of the Minnesota School Safety Center today, and I would be very happy to answer any questions.
Senator Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So your presentation focuses a lot on the technical aspects. When you go in and do assessments, do you consider things like counselor-to-student ratios or other types of things? Because this is sort of preventing things in a physical or an operations point of view. I mean, do you look at sometimes the causes of things where some students are alienated, and, you know, because Minnesota has some of the worst ratio of counselors to students to counselors in the country? I mean, is that something you take into consideration, or is that sort of outside the scope or purview of the work that you all do?
Yeah, Chair and members, we do discuss that just a little bit, but it is somewhat outside of the scope of what the Department of Public Safety and the School Safety Center actually works with, but it is part of the conversation when we are discussing threat assessment teams and that 360-degree view of an individual.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, do you have any idea, a rough estimate, how many schools or districts actually have a threat assessment team that's implemented at this point?
Chair and members, I really do not have a hard and fast number on that or even to give a safe estimate. Many of the schools are doing it already on somewhat of an informal basis, and they do have processes already in place within their schools. But some are not necessarily the full look, so we are assisting them with additional tools and ways that they could manage that.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I'm just a little curious. I represent Anoka Hennepin, which is the largest school district in the state, but my question is about, like, outside state rural districts, smaller districts, and things like that. Are you finding that there's a greater need in outstate Minnesota for your services, and are you spending a lot of time out there versus the metro?
Mr. Johnson?
Yeah, Chair and members, it's been interesting over the past 4 years that I've been with this group. Initially, we were doing quite a bit of the metro groups, the very large school districts. We worked very closely with Anoka Hennepin Schools on a variety of projects, and they've been doing fabulous work. Yeah. But as we move further and further out state, more of the question is the amount of resources that they have available, both within the schools and their partner agencies, be it public safety and others. What we have found, though, especially in the past year and a half, is an acute need with the charter schools and the private schools throughout the state, more so than the larger public schools who seem to have a larger resource pool. But the thing that we've been noticing quite a bit is the pairing and partnering between the public school districts and the private and charter schools as far as sharing some of the resources.
Representative Uglum?
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Yes, thank you. Anoka Hennepin just recently passed a $200 million bond issue, and I know that a lot of that money is, a significant amount of that money is going towards safety in the schools, both architecturally, building-wise, and personnel-wise. And some of these smaller charter schools and school districts, they don't have that wherewithal. Are there some specific instances that you could tell us a little bit about how you've helped some of these smaller districts?
Mr. Johnson?
Yes, Chair and members. There have been quite a few specific incidents where we were able to work with the smaller schools, charter schools especially. We were working with a Latino school in South Minneapolis who has as their current facility a revamped supermarket was the actual building that they were utilizing to house their school. And we were able to help them not only with some planning mechanisms for overall emergency planning, but especially with access controls, working within what they were capable of doing financially. We look for best answers, which are low cost, no cost, if at all possible, and then help assist them with connecting other resources that can help them with different technologies that would be very helpful.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really appreciate the opportunity to get an update on this. A couple of questions. The appropriations of $405,000, and you have an emergency planning coordinator position vacant. Are you looking to fill that? What's missing when you don't have someone in that position?
Representative Johnson.
Chair and members, what we ended up doing is being a little bit innovative within our group, and we have provided cross-training with the members of our team to fill that gap while we're operating right now. It would be helpful to have that additional position back to help us satisfy the needs and the requests from all the different schools throughout the state.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on a small staff, you need cross-training for sure. But so you are actively looking for someone, and you have the resources to hire a position?
Representative, Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Chair and members, it's a kind of a budget issue right now that all of us are working with, and our hope is that we would be able to replace at least that position, yes.
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm surprised that there are, if I heard you right, 75 SROs trained each year through your organization. Okay, looking at the whole state, and if I understood right, you estimate 350 full and part-time SROs in the state. It seems to me that, like Representative Ugle and I represent large school districts, and we've got SROs, so I'm thinking, you know, the three school districts that I work with have a really high percentage then of that 350. That surprises me. So are we just not funding them enough? Do we need more? What's your position on the availability and the training for SROs in the school?
Mr. Johnson?
Yeah, Chair and members, it does seem like somewhat of a low number throughout the entire state, and some of it is driven by resources.
Of course.
You know, very much. But what we do find, especially in greater Minnesota, if there are not officers that are specifically assigned as school resource officers, they do have an awful lot of contact with their local agencies somewhat on an informal basis.
Mr. Johnson, I also have a couple of minor questions. One, do you happen to know how many school safety evaluations you've done in the past 12 months?
Mr. Chair and members, as far as evaluations of a facility assessment,
that is correct.
We average probably close to 80 to 90 per year.
And of the number of training sessions that you have, is that in the last 12 months, is that roughly the same?
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And another question, Representative Ward sort of got into. Just wondering if you're able to keep up with the demand that you have for both the training and also the evaluation.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, we have not yet had to turn away a request, which I think is extremely important. However, there is a bandwidth capacity. We have had an uptick, as you, I'm sure, are imagining, with the events that have been happening throughout the United States. And the demand is high, but we've been able to, at this point, make our way to make sure it happens.
Okay, then one final question. We just recently had that terrible incident down in Florida. And what I'm wondering, when my own district have had a couple events that have occurred. I'm just wondering if you have enough staff or somebody to be able to participate in the debriefing afterwards in order to find out when you put these programs together in these safety evaluations, what worked and what didn't work to improve things throughout the state. If you're able to participate in those to find out if what you're doing is working correctly.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members, we are able to work with the State Fusion Center, which is through the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and we learn best practices following the investigations of these types of events, and we do incorporate that directly into our training, best practices that are learned on a very regular basis, yes.
I'm glad you're they're doing that part of it, because with the incident in my area, they found some things that work well, mm-hmm. and they found some areas that need improvement, and they found some things that this might not work. So they're improving their programs as well as these incidents occur, and I'm glad that you're able to get that information to make your plans for these other school districts to protect our kids even more available. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are all school resource officers licensed Minnesota police officers?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, all SROs that are in the schools are licensed Minnesota peace officers.
Thank you. That's a bit reassuring.
Any other questions from the members? Well, thank you for coming in today. It was very enlightening. And I remember somebody, can't remember who it was, asked the question about the number of school resource officers. I'm waiting for the text from the past president to find out the actual number. Next, we'll be hearing the report from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We have Nathaniel Reitz, the Executive Director, and Justice Christopher Dietzen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could you state your names, and you may begin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Christopher Dietzen. I'm a working retired Justice of Minnesota Supreme Court. I say that because I still sit on cases from time to time. More importantly for today, I'm one of 11 members of the commission and serve as its chair. Our statutory mandate is in establishing and modifying the sentencing guidelines. Our primary consideration is public safety, and we take that charge seriously. It's also based on the state public policy of maintaining uniformity, proportionality, rationality, and predictability in sentencing. In addition to that, the commission serves as a clearinghouse for providing information to others, and I know that some of you have from time to time requested information from us. We also collect and do ongoing research regarding data of how our sentencing guidelines have worked. Today, our purpose is to present the Commission's 2018 report to the legislature. I also am coming here today because I wanted to let you know that I am open if the commission has, or the committee, sorry, has topics that you wish the commission to consider. We would like to hear from you. I have spoken many months ago to your chair, Chair Johnson, and to former member Tony Cornish about our desire to maintain an open door, and I wish to say that publicly to all of you today. If there's any topic you wish the commission to take up in its work, we'd love to hear from you. And with that, I'd like to turn the podium over to our executive director, Nate Reitz, who will take you through a overview of the report.
Thank you, Justice Dietzen. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Nate Reitz. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Thank you for giving me the opportunity this morning to present to you the Commission's 2018 report to the legislature. The report to the legislature is a required report, although a number of the sections that I'm going to be going through are not required. Several of them are, and I'll be pointing that out as we go along. We do include in that report other information that we believe will be of interest to the legislature, and that report should have been provided to each member of this committee as well as each member of the Senate Judiciary Committee as required by law. I will not be using slides for this presentation. My materials are the report to the legislature. Feel free to follow along if you wish. Otherwise, I think I'll just be putting the parts I'll be talking about on the screen as well, so it's really up to you. On the second page after the title page, you'll see that the members of the commission, the only change here from last year is that we have a new peace officer member. Sergeant Salim Omari of the St. Paul Police Sergeant has very recently been appointed to replace Commander Paul Ford, who recently resigned from the commissioned due to conflicts with work. I'm going to be moving next to the introduction, which is on numbered page 2, and actually I'll be starts on page 1. I'll be talking a little bit here on figure 1. So in all but one of the first 37 years of the sentencing guidelines, from 1980 through 2016, Minnesota ranked among the states with the three lowest imprisonment rates in the nation, according to data from the Bureau of Justice Statistics. That remains true as of 2016. Minnesota, according to recently released data, has the third lowest imprisonment rate in the nation. That rate is 191 prisoners per 100,000 Minnesotans. In figure 1, you see the blue line. That shows the imprisonment rate for all states nationally, does not include federal prisoners, per 100,000 residents. And that goes all the way back from 1978, which coincidentally was about when the guidelines started getting up and running, to 2016. The green line shows the imprisonment rate for Minnesota over that same period of time. As figure 1 shows, the Minnesota imprisonment rate has grown since 1978, but not by as much as the all states rate. Recently, the all states rate, the blue line, has been falling. The Minnesota rate also fell by 2.6% from 2015 to 2016, but it does remain at its third highest rate since the guidelines were established. The next page is the executive summary, or begins the executive summary, and it shows the outline of the report to the legislature. The required sections are the modifications and proposed modifications to the sentencing guidelines, as well as the last section, which is the county attorney firearms report. The first section, which is not required, is the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, their preliminary report on the impact of the 2016 Drug Sentencing Reform Act. That act did require the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to study the impact of that law, and this is our very first report on the impact of that. Before we look at the impact of the Drug Sentencing Reform Act, though, I'd like to kind of jump toward the back of the report, or really right in the middle of the report, figure 16 on page 37. And I realize the copy you have may be black and white. I commend you on your frugality, but I would just tell you it probably will make more sense here to look at the screen because the different colors are going to show up better on the screen. So the top line of this chart shows the number of offenders sentenced in each year from the dawn of the guidelines back in 1981 through 2016, calendar year 2016. And you can see that that number of felony cases has been rising over time. The colors underneath the top line show the various types of cases grouped by broad categories. The green color represents the number of property offenses over time. That's the second band from the bottom. This was the largest category of sentences for the first 29 years of guidelines data. From 1981, here at the beginning, all the way through 2009, right here at this point. For the next 6 years, from 2010 through 2015, person offenses, which is the dark blue color at the bottom, took over as the most common class of offenses sentenced. In 2016, for the first time, drug offenses, which is this third band from the bottom, the light blue category, took over as the largest, the most common type of offense sentenced for that particular year. In 2016, drug offenses accounted for 32.3% of all felony cases sentenced in the state of Minnesota. The number of felony drug cases has seen rapid growth in the past as well. And bringing you back to 2002, you can see that the rise in that particular year was 31.9%. That category continued to rise for four more years until 2006. And you see the peak in drug cases, and also there was a local peak in the total number of cases that year. After that year, the number of cases, both drug cases and felony cases in general, began to recede for several years. In 2011, drug case volume began climbing again and has grown by between 7 and 14% for each of the past 4 years. During those same 4 years, case volume for person and property offenses has remained, on average, largely flat. Due in large part to the recent rise in drug cases, the total volume of felonies sentenced in 2016, just under 17,000 cases, was the highest volume on record, surpassing the previous record set the year before. It was in this context of rising drug cases that you enacted Chapter 160 of the 2016 Minnesota Session Laws. The courts call Chapter 160 the Drug Sentencing Reform Act. That's not the title that you gave it. I will be referring to it by that title or abbreviated as the DSRA because that's what the appellate courts have done. So I will begin our presentation on the impact of the Drug Sentencing Reform Act on page 6 of your materials. And on page 6, you'll see essentially an outline of this section of the report. As I said, the DSRA, one of its provisions was that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission must research the law's impact. And this report includes its first report on the measurable impact of the DSRA. I will caution you for the first time now and repeatedly throughout this report that these are preliminary results. We don't have a full year even worth of sentencing data. The law only took effect August 1st of 2016 and only for crimes committed on or after August 1st of 2016. And for us to measure the impact of a particular case, that crime has to be committed, have gone through the entire system, received a conviction, and received a sentence by the time we measured it. And most of our measuring stopped at the end of June of 2017. So when we talk about cases affected by the Drug Sentencing Reform Act, for the most part, we're talking about crimes that were committed on or after August 1st of 2016 and sentenced by the end of June of 2017. In future years, we hope to have more information for you, less preliminary information and more final information and broader information as well. On page 7, you'll see a thumbnail summary of the 2016 DSRA, and that summary continues on page 8. There are a number of policies that the DSRA implemented. This is just a thumbnail of them, and I will shrink that down even more by just highlighting 6 policies. First, the DSRA adopted a modified version of the drug offender grid that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission had proposed. That grid is shown on page 77 of your report, if you'd like to look at that. That grid altered some durations and dispositions recommended for some serious drug offenses. Second, the DSRA enhanced some drug crimes. Third, the DSRA increased weight thresholds for first through third degree sale, first through second degree possession of cocaine and methamphetamine. Fourth, the DSRA restricted the use of mandatory minimum prison sentences for subsequent drug offenses. Fifth, the DSRA allowed first-time possession of trace amounts of drugs to be a gross misdemeanor. And finally, the DSRA expanded eligibility for, and in some cases mandated, stays of adjudication for lower-level drug possession offenses. On page 9 and spilling over to page 10, you'll see table 1. This table is really a follow-up to the chart we saw earlier that just talks about the volume of drug cases. And I'm going to turn to the bottom line here over the various years. You'll see that there was a rise in the total number of drug cases sentenced in 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016. And We actually have a peak here at 2017 data for the first 6 months of 2017 data in the hopes that maybe we're past the peak of this rise in drug cases that we've seen. Unfortunately, we don't have good news for you from our 2017 data. That's a six-month number, and that number is let's see, 9.6% more cases than we saw during the same 6 months in 2016. So it doesn't look like we've hit that peak yet. And I should point out, Table 1 involves both pre- and post-DSRA cases. We don't we aren't at the point in this report where we're breaking out DSRA cases from
I believe Representative Hilstrom has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, yes, looking at that then, where would the gross misdemeanors that are permitted be on this chart?
They are not on this chart. We will include them on a later chart, but this is just felony cases. So even taking out whatever gross misdemeanors there were during that first 6 months of 2017, I doubt there were many during the last few months of 2016, but even taking those out, we're still seeing a 9.6% year-over-year increase for the first 6 months of the year.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question was, is it actually higher? Because if now you can have a gross misdemeanor, however many cases were grosses would be added to this number.
Mr. Eats.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, that is correct.
Please continue.
Thank you. So, let's see, we're going to look at figure 3 on page 11. So, figure 3 shows the distribution of offenders by drug type. This data, I will caution you, is pretty broad data. It's taken from codes that prosecutors' offices enter on criminal complaints called MOC codes. And it is limited in terms of the number of categories that it shows. We have a little more precise data for the post-DSRA cases that I'll show you shortly. But this does give us a picture over time of the types of drugs that are involved in these felony sentences over time. Just broadly, of course, here you see graphically the fall from the 2006 local peak down to 2010, and then the rise again to 2016. But you also see the drug types involved. So there is a consistent decline in the cocaine category, which is, well, a fairly consistent decline in the cocaine category, which is the dark blue area on the bottom of the chart. There's also a recent rise in the heroin category, although it's a much smaller category by number of cases. That's this light blue category, third from the bottom. But I would primarily observe that there's a dominance and resurgence of methamphetamine and related drugs. Those are shown by the green category, which is the largest category on the chart. The recent rise in the number of drug cases is associated with a similarly striking rise in the number of methamphetamine cases.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is consistent with my experience. The vast majority of cases that I charge, drug cases, involve meth. I guess I didn't realize, though, that it was so recent. It looks like it's just 2012 that there's such a huge increase. And I'm just wondering, and I don't know if you know from the information you have, but I guess I would not have thought, it wouldn't have occurred to me about that timing. Of course, we've been hearing about concerns about methamphetamine for so long. Do you have any sense as to why, at least if I'm reading the chart right, it looks like it's really just been, you know, in the past 5 years that there's been such a huge explosion, as dominant as it was before?
Mr. Reitz?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, so there was a during that peak that we saw in 2006, there was also sort of a peak of methamphetamine cases, and then methamphetamine cases fell and then rose again. I am trying to stay within my lane of knowledge here. I can tell you that meth manufacturing used to be a bigger deal, that really reduced. Again, I'm not going to claim causality here because it's outside the scope of my job, but when you put Sudafed behind the counter, that really reduced the number of methamphetamine cases. I think as far as the recent methamphetamine being high-quality methamphetamine coming from Mexico, that's not within the scope of my expertise, so I can't really comment on that, but I can repeat what I've heard.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe just a quick follow-up. So I guess maybe I was misreading it a little bit, that really we had some success in the late 2000s compared to 2006 leading to 2011, 2012, and then it's kind of exploded back up again, if I'm reading the chart right, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, there was sustained success in reducing the number of meth manufacturing cases. There was temporary success in reducing the number of meth cases overall, and all the ground that was gained, if you will, has been lost.
Okay. Thank you.
So I'm turning the page now to page 12. At this point in the report, we're going to be talking about what we're calling post-DSRA cases. These are the cases that where the offense occurred after August 1st of 2016, so they were subject to the DSRA, and the sentence was imposed by the end of June of 2017. So again, this is less than a full year's worth of data. But we did read the complaints on every one of these cases based on our mandate to research the impact of the Drug Sentencing Reform Act. So we have a little bit more refined data as far as what the drug types were in that post-DSRA group. Again, we found that meth was the dominant drug type, representing over 65% of the post-DSRA felony cases sentenced. Cocaine, marijuana, and heroin each accounted for between 6 and 8% of those cases. And this is a very long and slow follow-up to a question that Representative Hillstrom once asked me as I testified before this committee regarding the frequency of fentanyl and carfentanil prosecutions, and I did not have an answer for her at that time. But after we reviewed all the complaints associated with the 1,349 felony post-DSRA cases, I can now report that we found only two fentanyl cases and no carfentanil cases. To measure the impact of the DSRA, we compared the post-DSRA group with groups from similar time periods in previous years. Consistent with the recent rise in drug cases, we saw an increase in the post-DSRA group. And let me turn to page table 3 here. So the 2014-2015 comparison group are those cases that were committed on or after August 1st of 2014 and sentenced by the end of June of 2015 to make it a comparable group to our post-DSRA group. Same thing with the 2015 to 2016 group. So these are the cases that we're comparing to do a valid comparison to our limited sample of post-DSRA groups. We similarly limited ourselves and our samples from previous years. Consistent with the recent rise in drug cases, we saw an increase in the post-DSRA group compared to previous years, although this would have been less true if we had not included in Table 3 new gross misdemeanor cases. So partially in response to the question that Representative Hillstrom asked before, in this table, and I think maybe only this table, we add back in the gross misdemeanor cases, and with those gross misdemeanor cases added back in, we do see an increase in the number of post-DSRA cases. That gross misdemeanor category would not have been possible before the DSRA. Now moving to page 16. and Table 5. In restricting the use of mandatory minimums, implementing the drug offender grid, and increasing the weight thresholds for cocaine and methamphetamine, it was anticipated that the DSRA might increase sentence uniformity. Another way of saying that is to decrease the departure rate from the sentencing guidelines. This table shows mitigated dispositional departure rates for the two comparison groups and the post-DSRA group. A mitigated dispositional departure occurs when the guidelines recommend prison, but the sentence that's imposed does not include prison. It includes a probationary sentence. Overall, the mitigated dispositional departure rate went down from 30 and 34% in the comparison groups to 27% in the post-DSRA group. The mitigated, and you see that on the bottom line, the total line, the mitigated dispositional departure rate change was most pronounced in the second degree category, where the drug offender grid now presumes a stayed sentence for offenders with small criminal history scores. Before, that line presumed a presumptive commit for all offenders. The post-DSRA mitigated dispositional departure rate of 18.5%, which you see here, is far less than the rates of 34 and 38% seen in the comparison groups. Turning the page to Table 6.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. I want to actually take you back to the 9% increase that you cited when you look at page 9. When you add back in those 373 cases, if you take into account that that would only be for half of the year and just double it, that would be 6,436 cases, which is almost exactly 1,000 cases more than the year before. So that's like one-sixth, right? One-fifth of an increase. So almost a 20% increase in drug cases.
I think that's valid.
So anyways, maybe you could just look at that later and get that back to us, but there's a difference, a big difference between a 9% increase in drug cases and a 20% increase in drug cases. Mm-hmm. And the impact that that will have in our sentencing at the end of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's a little bit, not quite apples to apples, but maybe, two different varieties of apples, because some of those gross misdemeanor cases would have been sentenced in 2016, but I think there is certainly evidence there to make one inquire as to whether or not it wouldn't have been significantly higher if the gross misdemeanor cases had been added back in.
Okay.
All right, so we're back on page 17 on table 6. So we talked about uniformity as measured by mitigated dispositional departure rates. Now we're going to be talking about uniformity as measured by mitigated durational departure rates. A mitigated durational departure occurs when an offender is sentenced to prison, just as the guidelines presume that the offender should be, but they're sentenced to prison for a shorter period of time than the duration of time that the guidelines presumed. Overall, the mitigated durational departure rates fell to 20% for the post-DSRA group, compared with 28 and 26% in the comparison groups. And if you turn the page to Figure 5, you'll see the same information graphically. The mitigated durational departure rates for the five drug degrees in the post-DSRA group is shown in light blue. So dark blue, the left column for each drug degree is the 2014 to 2015 group. The middle column, the green column, is the 2015 to 2016. And then the far right, the light blue column for each drug group is drug degree is the post-DSRA group. Post-DSRA, you can see that the mitigated durational departures fell for first, second, and third degree offenses. So the early evidence in summary suggests that the DSRA had a generally positive impact on sentence uniformity. although I reiterate that because these groups all contain significantly less than a complete year's worth of sentencing data, these results should be viewed as preliminary. The next section of the report has to do with prison bed savings. Because the DSRA adjusted some drug offenses to lesser degrees and moved some to gross misdemeanors, it was anticipated that the act would result in prison bed savings. So far, the preliminary data show that this has not occurred. Looking at Table 7 on page 19, you'll see that the estimated prison beds needed for the post-DSRA group's executed prison sentences was 621 prison beds. So this is simply taking the pronounced executed sentences for the offenders being sentenced in the post-DSRA group and dividing that by two-thirds to calculate the number of prison beds needed. So that's assuming, obviously not perfectly, that every offender will serve exactly two-thirds of their time and be placed on supervised release at the end of that period. So that's why they call these estimated prison beds. But using the same method to look at the two comparison groups, we see that they had about the same number of prisoners. So there was a little bit more in the 2014 to 15 comparison group and a little bit less in the 2015 to 2016 comparison groups. So there didn't seem to be any realization in the anticipated prison bed savings. And that appears to be the continuing increases in the number of drug offenses that were sentenced, as we discussed above. That's not to say, however, that the DSRA had no impact on prison beds. And I'm now turning to Table 8 on page 21.
Representative Dean?
I think he's going to get to my question.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a question about this chart on page 19. So if under the fifth degree controlled substance line, you have an average duration of months, which is higher than the number in the sentencing guidelines typically, unless you get out to five or six, that assumes that all of these folks have higher criminal history scores, because otherwise if they just executed a sentence for a first or second time or even up to fourth time, fifth degree controlled substance person, they wouldn't be doing 17 months based on the sentencing guidelines. So is that an accurate read of this chart, that if approximately, let's look at 16 and 17, the average number of months, 17 months for 186 people at the fifth degree controlled substance, that means that all of those folks are going to be have a criminal history score of six or higher.
Mr. Reitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, that's an average. So over, and that was consistent with the previous groups, the fifth degree offenders, if they went to prison, and most fifth degree offenders were not initially sentenced to prison. And keep in mind, this is not tracking probation violations. We don't really have good data on probation violations. So the data we're giving you is the initial prison sentences. You're really going to get there from one of three ways. One is an aggravated durational departure or dispositional departure. We don't see a lot of those. One is a demand for execution, as you pointed out. And the third is that you have that the offender has such a high criminal history score that even at a low severity offense like fifth degree controlled substance crime, the guidelines presume that the proper sentence is a prison sentence. So I think that's probably why the number is as high as it is, because of the offenders who are originally, and I don't have the data right in front of me, but I don't find it terribly surprising that it's as high as it is for offenders who are being originally sentenced to prison for an offense as low as fifth degree. Those are going to be offenders generally with higher criminal history scores and therefore longer durations on that particular line of the grid. So moving to Table 8 on page 24. to test whether or not the DSRA had an impact on prison beds, we did this. We broke up the post-DSRA cases into categories based on how much quantity they had of a particular drug when we read the complaints, and whether or not the controlled substance in question was sold or merely possessed. So we took all these cases from the post-DSRA group and put them in different categories based on the quantity of drugs and whether it was sold or possessed. Then we did the same thing to all the cases sentenced in 2015. We read all those complaints, and we put all those cases in different categories and figured out the average sentence for each category as sentenced in 2015. Then we reassigned the cases sentenced, the post-DSRA group, cases sentenced, we reassigned those, the sentences that they would have gotten if they had been sentenced in 2015 before the DSRA was in effect. And what we found, again, based on preliminary part year data, was that if the post-DSRA cases had been sentenced in 2015 rather than post-DSRA as they were sentenced, the prison bed demand for the post-DSRA group would have been 26% higher than it actually was. So that's 26% is that 621 number, which was the estimated number of prison beds they actually needed based on their actual sentences, versus the 842 number, which is the estimated number of prison beds that they would have needed if they had been sentenced like a similar case was sentenced in 2015. It will be interesting to see if this holds up with more data, but it preliminarily appears that while the need for prison beds may not have shrunk following enactment of the DSRA, the DSRA may nevertheless have bent down the rising prison bed demand curve caused by the increase in drug cases that we've been encountering this decade.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any tracking of the people that got sentenced to a lighter time period if they end up coming back around and reoffending, and now we're offering them a bed anyway, as if we would have just charged them with a felony and we would have just kept them in prison anyway? I mean, is there any proof that we give them a lighter sentence and give them a second chance here that we are being successful and not having them come back?
Mr. Wright?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howell, that's a great question. This is, as I've been saying, this is very preliminary data. This is fresh out of the oven. We can certainly try to look at recidivism in the future, but right now we're pedaling as fast as we can just to give you the data of the sentences that they got. Many of them are still serving those sentences, and we may not know recidivism data for several, many, many years. So we're going to turn to the next section of the DSRA report, which has to do with another policy that the DSRA created, which was this gross misdemeanor fifth-degree offense for first-time possession of trace amounts of drugs. According to the judicial branch, and this is not our in-house data at this point, this is judicial branch data, there were 601 convictions for the new gross misdemeanor offense sentenced between August 1st, 2016, and October 19th, 2017. This figure shows where those cases were distributed, and that's the green bar in the middle of each judicial district. That shows what percentage of those 601 gross misdemeanor offenses were sentenced in that particular judicial district. To the left of the green bar, the dark blue bar, that shows previously where felony trace cases were being prosecuted before the law was enacted. So we looked at the quantity of drugs in complaints previous to the DSRA in 2015. to see if they would have qualified as trace amounts and show you the distribution by judicial district of the felony trace cases. Now, not all of these cases would have necessarily qualified for gross misdemeanor treatment because to be a gross misdemeanor trace case, you can't have a prior drug conviction on your record. And some of these may have had drug convictions, but it does show by drug quantity where these cases had been prosecuted previously. The right bar, the lighter blue bar, gives you an idea of the population distribution, what percentage of Minnesota's population lives in each of those judicial districts. And the judicial district maps, if you're curious, are on page 62 of your report. Now, the 4th Judicial District, Hennepin County, you'll see had 22.5% of the population of the state, age 15 and older, but only 1.5% of the new gross misdemeanor trace cases. We speculate that this may somehow be related to the fact that in Hennepin and Ramsey counties only, the DSRA gave city attorneys rather than county attorneys the duty to prosecute gross misdemeanor trace cases, although I'm not really sure why that particular fact would cause there to be a low number of gross misdemeanor trace cases in Hennepin County and lower than we were seeing in 2015.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wright, I just wanted to clarify that that when it says trace, it's using the quantities, the 0.25 grams or less for other drugs and 0.05 for heroin, as opposed to, I think of those quantities as opposed to the term trace, but those are used interchangeably in putting together this data?
Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. And I'm going to phone a friend on this one, but I think the correct answer is that we read all of the 2015 cases. If it said the word trace, or if it said the word residue, or if it had a quantity defined that would have met the DSRA's definition, and the DSRA does not actually use the term trace,
right,
but if it met the definition of small amount of drugs that everybody refers to as trace amounts, then we included it that as in the dark blue bars at the front. So we did resort to that definition, the DSRA's definition, in supplying the felony trace cases from 2015.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. So I think I understand what you're saying, and that makes sense. I'm now seeing in the footnote there's a reference, because, of course, somebody can get a felony even if they have a trace amount, but they have a prior conviction. It looks like those cases where the offender has a prior conviction, were not excluded from the data. And I guess I would be worried that that would skew things quite a bit, because in my experience, I often will have a case where somebody may have 0.19 grams of meth, let's say, so that counts as a trace under the DSRA, but the person has a prior drug conviction, so therefore it's a felony. It feels like, if I'm reading this right, it feels like that might skew the data somewhat.
Mr.
Chair, Representative Pinto, It might. We did put that in the footnote to fully disclose that we didn't look at the criminal history of each one of those people. That would have been more difficult to do, and I don't know that it would have made a difference for the purposes of this, where we're trying to show whether or not these trace cases were being prosecuted in a given judicial district previous to the DSRA. I don't know that whether or not the offender had a prior would have made a difference in the validity of that distribution that we're showing in this table, but to the extent it would have, it may have skewed the data. I just don't know in which direction it would have skewed it, and we're giving you the data for what it's worth.
So I guess, Mr. Chair, so the final point of this, I guess if I'm understanding you right, Mr. Wright, it sounds like the bars there under felony trace cases 2015, those percentages do include some percentage of cases where the person had a trace amount and a prior conviction. Previously, they were charged with a felony, and under the new scenario, they also would be charged with a felony. So they'd be included in the bar to 2015, but not under the bar to 2016, 2017. And that's, I think, where the data would go.
Mr. Wright.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, that is correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Another provision of the DSRA, and we're now turning to page 26. That it expanded the eligibility for statutory stays of adjudication, which is under section 152.18, and it made stays of adjudication mandatory in some cases. This figure shows how many stays of adjudication dispositions occurred for drug offenses in 2015, 2016, and most of 2017. And this is judicial branch data. Since these are stays of adjudication, they're not sentenced, and we don't get the data. The green portions of the bars represent the number of cases that were committed after August 1st of 2016 and would therefore be subject to the DSRA. And as you can see from Figure 10, the stays of adjudication were on the rise, at least from this limited sample of years, even without the DSRA. But the number of stays of adjudication rose further after the DSRA took effect. With respect to the green portion of this chart, it should be noted that 46% of the post-DSRA stays of adjudication were for the new gross misdemeanor offense that we just discussed. So, Mr. Chair, that wraps up this first section of the report to the legislature dealing with the Drug Sentencing Reform Act. I'd be happy to answer any questions about that, or we could move on to the rest of the report to the legislature at this time.
It appears we get to move on.
All right. So now turning to page 30 of the report to the legislature, which describes the commission's activities in 2017. One of the fundamental responsibilities of the commission is to maintain and improve the guidelines by amending them in response to legislative changes, case law, and issues raised by various parties. In order to meet this responsibility and its responsibility to conduct ongoing research into sentencing practices and other matters relating to the improvement of the criminal justice system, the Commission met 10 times during 2017 and held one public hearing on July 20th of 2017. Topics of interest to the Commission in 2017 included life sentences for juveniles, which you heard about last week, the Commission's demographic impact statement policy, guidelines, implications of important case law in Minnesota, sentencing practices for repeat violent offenders, and an ongoing review of Minnesota's criminal history score. Be happy to pause if there are any questions about those areas, or move on to the next section, which is found on the bottom of page 31.
Here we get to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is the first section I'm showing you that is a required section that we are required by law to report to you. Now, the Commission is required to report to you its modifications to the sentencing guidelines made in the previous year. You created the offense of damage to property of a public safety motor vehicle. The Commission ranked that new offense at a severity level 3, which is where the highest ranked version of criminal damage to property in the first degree had been ranked before. You created the offense of use of automated sales suppression devices within the tax evasion laws. The Commission left the new offense ranked at severity level 3, which is where the rest of the tax evasion laws are also ranked. You created a felony offense for repeatedly impersonating a peace officer. The Commission ranked that new offense at a severity level 2. Commission made some technical changes as well. Based on some technical amendments you made to the unemployment benefits fraud statute, the Commission voted to rename that offense to unemployment benefit fraud to be consistent with your technical changes. The Commission also made some technical corrections to the sentencing guidelines, striking an obsolete cross-reference and an unnecessary word. And all these changes went into effect August 1st of 2017 and are fully reproduced in Appendix 3, which begins on page 66. The next section of our report, which is also a mandatory section, is proposed modifications to the guidelines. That begins on the bottom of page 32. The Commission is required to report to you its proposed changes to the sentencing guidelines. These changes are proposed to go into effect August 1st of 2018, unless the legislature by law provides otherwise. The first change has to do with the sentencing guidelines statement of purpose and principles. And I'm now on page 33. 40 years ago this month, next month I should say, on April 5th, 1978, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission was established by law in Minnesota Statute Section 244.09. Although the legislature amended the commission's charter statute in 1989 and 1996 to emphasize the considerations of public safety and the long-term negative impact of crime on the community, the sentencing guidelines themselves were never changed to reflect those amendments. The commission now proposes to modify its statement of purpose and principles to reflect those 1989 and 1996 statutory changes. The second proposed modification has to do with the rarely seen escape from electronic home monitoring offense. This is an unranked offense by the sentencing guidelines, but it is not listed on the list of unranked offenses. The commission proposes to correct this oversight and add it to the list. Finally, there is a comment in the guidelines that contains a list of designated offenses that by definition involve a firearm or other dangerous weapon and therefore automatically carry a mandatory minimum penalty under Minnesota Statute 6911. We found that this list had an offense that did not belong on there and was missing an offense that did belong on there, so we proposed to correct the list. All these proposed changes are fully reproduced in Appendix 4, beginning on page 72. The next section of the report has to deal with staff activities. I previously mentioned in passing the commission's, the commission does produce a number of data reports, including a controlled substance offense report, and a summary data report. We also produced over 300 individualized data reports at the request of practitioners, researchers, and others. We also review sentencing worksheets and collect and match sentencing data in nearly 17,000 cases last year, conduct training and application of the guidelines, and answered hundreds of phone calls answering guidelines questions, and we assisted in the preparation of fiscal notes for crime bills. And, of course, staff assists the commission in doing its policy-related work. I'm now moving on to the section of our report where we provide you with a summary of felony sentencing practices. And specifically, I'm turning to page 38. We already talked about the figure on the previous page, figure 16 on page 37. Table 10 on page 38 shows you year by year the percent change in each of the categories that we showed you on figure 16. And I'd like to pull your attention to the bottom line, which shows the most recent year's changes in each category. In total, the number of felony sentences grew by 1% from 2015 to 2016. Most categories actually fell. Those are the categories with the negative number signs in front of them, green on this chart. Felony DWI, which has had some dramatic swings in recent years, fell by 19% from 2015 to 2016. The property and person categories each fell by less than 4%. The drug category, as we've already discussed, grew by 11% to become the largest category. Turning the page to page 39, figure 17 shows the change in the distribution of felony sentences by race over the 36 years the commission has been collecting data. The percentage of offenders who are white was 58% in 2016, and that's the largest color on the bottom of your chart, the blue color. That percentage has stayed in the high 50s for the past decade. The percentage of offenders who are black was at almost 25% in 2016, which is as low as it's been for the past decade. The percentage of offenders who are American Indian was at 8.7% in 2016, which is its highest percentage in guidelines history. The 3.1% mark for the percentage of offenders who are Asian is also at a high point. The percentage of offenders who are Hispanic was at 5.3% in 2016, which is similar to the percentage in recent years. Table 11 on page 41 shows the number of felony offenders sentenced in 2016 broken down by gender, race, and ethnicity and by judicial district. And that's all in the left three columns of this table. This table also shows the estimated 2016 population of the state of Minnesota, age 15 and older, by each of those categories. And those are in the next three columns of this table. The final column on the far right shows how many felony offenders were sentenced in 2016 per 100,000 residents in each category. So we're essentially taking the data on the right side, the left side of the table, and comparing it to the data on the right side of the table, and we come up with the number of offenders sentenced in 2016 per 100,000 Minnesota residents. We see that that number, the bottom line of the table, shows that 381 felony offenders were sentenced in Minnesota in 2016 per 100,000 Minnesota residents. That number was much higher for male offenders than female offenders, for American, Indian, and black felony offenders than other offenders, and for offenders in the 9th Judicial District than offenders in other judicial districts. On page 43, I'm looking at figure 19. This shows the total incarceration rates during guidelines history. The light blue line on top shows the percentage of offenders over time who received some sort of incarceration as part of their felony sentence. This is a sum of the dark blue line below, which represents the percentage of offenders who received local incarceration, and the green line below that, which represents the percentage of offenders who received confinement in prison as part of their original felony sentence. 92% of felony offenders sentenced in 2016 received some sort of incarceration as part of their sentence. Specifically, two-thirds of offenders received local jail time, and over 25% received a prison sentence, for a total of 92%. We will now discuss departures from the sentencing guidelines on page 47. As figure 21 shows, in 74% of cases sentenced in 2016, the sentence was not a departure from the sentence recommended by the sentencing guidelines. In 22% of cases, the sentence was a mitigated departure. A mitigated departure, as we've discussed, is a sentence that is more lenient than the sentence that the sentencing guidelines would recommend. On page 48, you'll see the total dispositional, and it continues on. You see table 13. It starts on page 48 and continues on to 49. This table shows dispositional departures. A dispositional departure is a deviation from the sentencing guidelines recommendation with respect to whether or not an executed prison sentence should be imposed. The table's rightmost column displays the mitigated dispositional departure rates. A mitigated dispositional departure occurs when a judge sentences an offender to probation when the guidelines recommend prison. The overall mitigated dispositional departure rate, as you see on the bottom right corner of this chart, of this table, was 35.9%. The mitigated dispositional departure rates varied somewhat by race, from a low of 29.1% for Hispanic offenders to a high of 39% for Asian offenders. An even greater degree of variation may be seen by gender and geographically by judicial district. Turning the page to figure 23, this figure shows the mitigated dispositional departure rate by high departure rate offenses. For one type of offense, more offenders receive mitigated dispositional departures than do not receive mitigated dispositional departures. That's second-degree assault. 56% of second-degree assault offenders received a mitigated dispositional departure in 2016. This offense is listed in Minnesota Statute 60911 as an offense that always carries a presumptive prison sentence when committed with a firearm or other dangerous weapon, and by definition, it is always committed with a firearm or other dangerous weapon, so it always carries a presumptive commit to prison. Regarding the drug offenses, it should be noted that most drug offenses sentenced in 2016 were not governed by the DSRA. So both DSRA and pre-DSRA offenses are included here. On the next page, figure 24, I said that a mitigated departure is when the judge's sentence deviates from the sentencing guidelines recommendation, but I don't want to leave the impression that the sentencing judge is acting alone. Figure 24 shows the position of the prosecutor when there was a mitigated dispositional departure for those same high departure offenses. The judicial departure reports record that in 60% of cases, the prosecutor agreed with or did not object to the departure. And in a significant number of cases, there was no position recorded. So we don't know whether the prosecutor agreed with or objected to the departure. On the next page, on table 14, this table shows durational departures. The durational departures shown on this table occur when the judge sentences the offender to prison, but for a shorter or longer period of time than the range of time recommended by the sentencing guidelines. The table's rightmost columns display the mitigated durational departure rates. That's when a judge sentences an offender to a shorter prison sentence than the recommended range. The overall mitigated durational departure rate, shown at the bottom right corner of this table, was 23.7%. The mitigated durational departure rates varied somewhat by race, from a low of 15% for American Indian offenders to a high of 33.5% for African-American offenders. An even greater degree of variation may be seen geographically by judicial district. On page 54, figure 25 shows the mitigated and aggravated durational departure rate by high departure offenses. Again, regarding the drug offenses, it should be noted that most drug offenses sentenced in 2016 were not governed by the DSRA. And again, figure 26 on the next page shows that in most cases, the prosecutor either agrees with or does not object to the mitigated departure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask Mr. Wrights. I noticed that the other sections have a comparison over time, but this section doesn't so much. It's just focusing on 2016. And I just wondered if you have a sense as to how departures have shifted over time, or if you have that information that could be provided at another time.
Mr. Wright. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pinto, that's an excellent opportunity for me to plug one of our data reports, which is our summary data report for offenders in 2016, and that, well, again, I'm going to phone a friend, but I believe that includes departure rates over time. Right again. So, yeah, and that's on our website. So all of our data reports are on the website, and that'll give you an idea of how that's changed over time. So it really, in a way, this section of the report to the legislature is almost an executive summary of that whole data report. So we include some of the information, but we can't include all of it.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you believe that the high rate mitigated durational departures under the first-degree drugs and the second-degree drugs that don't have the prosecutor's consent, the 20% on first-degree and the 17% on second-degree, were those most likely after the legislature passed the change in sentencing guidelines and these people would have been impacted had the law been in effect?
Mr. Wright?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that's a really good question, and it's very hard for me to answer. I know that during the time after the DSRA was enacted, but before the DSRA took effect, we would field calls where people were confused about, you know, whether or not they could avail themselves of the new penalties under the DSRA, or And we did see some departures where the reason for the departure was the DSRA, even though it wasn't in effect yet. In fact, some of that even occurred when the commission was considering action or had taken action in late 2015, when they had proposed changes to the drug offender grid that were included with modifications, I would say, by the DSRA. So I can't quantify how much that legal state of flux was affecting departure rates, but it's entirely possible it did affect departure rates.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the final section of our report is the third required section of our report, and that's found on page 56. The commission has the statutory duty to collect data from the 87 county attorneys regarding their cases allegedly involving firearms and to report that data to you. I will say it's not always been true, but it was true. And tip of the hat to the County Attorneys Association that we did get data from all 87 counties this year. Minnesota Statute 60911 creates mandatory minimum penalties applicable to a group of designated offenses when those offenses are committed with a firearm or other dangerous weapon. If you'd like to know which offenses are on that list, you can look at footnote 83. When a designated offense is allegedly committed while possessing or using a firearm, the county attorney must report that information to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and we must summarize and analyze that information and report it to you. This information is reported by fiscal year, not calendar year. Figure 27 shows the number of these cases disposed of by year, starting from when the mandate began in 1996. After a multi-year climb to a 2015 peak, the number of cases has fallen for the past 2 years to 1,116 cases in fiscal year 2017. Figure 28, which is on page 58, shows how those 1,116 cases were disposed of last year. So if you follow the flow, the 64 cases that peel off first on the left were not charged. Then you see that 180 cases were charged but not convicted. 115 more were convicted of an offense other than a designated offense, so they wouldn't have been eligible for the 6911 mandatory penalties. That left 757 cases that were convicted of a designated offense. Of those 757 cases, in 70 cases, the use or possession of a firearm was not established on the record. That is to say, it wasn't proven to the judge or jury or admitted as part of the guilty plea. That left 687 cases eligible for the mandatory minimum. The mandatory minimum for most of these offenses when they involve a firearm is 3 years in prison or 5 years for possession of a firearm by someone previously convicted of a crime of violence. The mandatory minimum for repeat conviction of a designated offense while using or possessing a dangerous weapon is 5 years. Although the statute uses the term mandatory, the sentencing judge is permitted to waive the mandatory minimum if it finds substantial and compelling reasons to do so. That option to waive the mandatory minimum is not available for that 5-year penalty for a repeat conviction of a designated offense. County attorneys reported that in 402 of the 687 cases to which the mandatory minimums applied, the mandatory minimum sentence was imposed and executed. In the remaining 285 cases, it was not. Mr. Chair, subject to your questions, that concludes our presentation of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission's 2018 report to the legislature.
Members, have any questions? I want to thank you for coming here today, providing this committee with some very good information. Our next meeting will be tomorrow. We will be adjourned.